from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. National Review senior editor and American Enterprise Institute fellow Jonah Goldberg has a new book called The Suicide of the West. It's a defense of American democracy and economic order and a warning cry that identity politics, nationalism, and populism threaten our institutions and our values.
There's nothing wrong with a little populism, right? There's nothing wrong with a little nationalism. It's like a pinch of salt brings out the flavor in the meal. Too much ruins the meal, and way too much is literally poison.
Jonah Goldberg joins us in studio to discuss his book and the current political climate. It's all coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In his new book, Suicide of the West, Jonah Goldberg argues that identity politics are dismantling the institutions essential to American society. Part political history, part expository essay, the work chronicles the evolution of Western civilization from tribalism to liberal democratic capitalism. Jonah Goldberg argues that the latter has driven the immense improvement in quality of lives over the past century, and that current political trends threaten to undermine that progress. And we welcome Jonah Goldberg back to the Forum program, this time live and in person. Good to have you here.
It's a real treat. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin with one of the real serious underlying premises, and there are many serious premises in this book, but we're talking about really almost dark ages of poverty and terrible illnesses and destructive health among human beings, among the human species. And then along comes this, what you call miracle, democratic liberal capitalism, origins of which, despite maybe Dutch and UK roots, may still be somewhat obscure.
Yeah. So one of the reasons I make the arguments the way I make them in the book is what I'm trying to do is model something I don't think is going on enough, particularly on my side, on the conservative side these days, which is actually try to make an argument that persuades people who don't agree with me rather than just sort of preach to my own choir, which is why the first sentence of the book is, there is no God in this book. And I'm trying to argue on fundamentally secular, essentially progressive modern terms that liberal democratic capitalism has been great for all of the things that concern modern progressive secular people, if you, with the exception possibly of income inequality, which we can get to. If you care about public health, if you care about reducing bigotry and racism, if you care about alleviating poverty, then this thing I call the miracle, which is sort of the whole package of liberal democratic capitalism, is the only thing in the broad sweep of human history of the last 250,000 years that has improved the plight of the average human being in not just demonstrable terms, but miraculous terms. Poverty is natural. For 250,000 years, the average human being everywhere in the world lived on less than $3 a day. And for the first time, only one time in all of human history, did that start to change. And it started to change because of these transformations that take place in England and also, according to some people, Holland, and then spread throughout Europe, come to North America, and they're still unfolding now. We live in this moment, in the greatest moment of poverty alleviation in all of human history, where hundreds of millions of people in Asia, Africa, are being lifted out of extreme poverty. And the designation of extreme poverty may vanish in our lifetimes.
You know, reading your book, I couldn't help thinking of Steve Pinker's book because there are parallels.
Sure.
I mean, he makes that similar argument. Things have never been better, although, you know, things in terms of threats from all kinds of extremism and cyber problems and all the rest of it probably should be factored in. That was my response after reading Pinker's book. But we also recently had Amy Chua on, the Yale law professor, and there are some parallels there in the sense of you're saying we should be grateful, but not only that, we should be, well, alarmed and certainly concerned, deeply and profoundly concerned about the dangers and the perils to this, largely because of tribalism, populism, nationalism, and all. I mentioned Amy Chua because she wrote a book on tribalism. These are the dangers as you see it.
That's right. I like Amy Chua's book a great deal, and I wish it came out maybe a year before mine so I could have used some of the stuff in there because there's some great stuff in there. But this threat, I mean, part of my point is that this threat is always with us because all of the threats of things like tribalism, identity politics, nationalism are fundamentally grounded in human nature. One of my favorite intellectuals, Hannah Arendt, used to say that every generation, Western civilization is invaded by barbarians. We call them children. Human beings come into this world naked, penniless, and ignorant. And they come with a lot of loaded software, sort of preloaded software, which we would call human nature. But they also need updates, and that starts with the family. And if you don't teach people, if you don't civilize people, civilization is a verb, if you don't civilize people to have an attachment to the things I think we all care about, human nature rushes in and tells us to live tribally, that we should be, that we, to distrust strangers. People say you have to be taught to hate. That's not true. You have to be taught not to hate. There is an enormous amount of psychological research that shows that we have an innate distrust of strangers from almost the moment we're born. And one of the great things about capitalism is that it lowers the barrier of distrust. So you no longer see strangers as enemies or threats, but you see them as potentially customers or fellow citizens. And that's what civilizations do. And we need to teach people from the earliest days. We need to socialize them and civilize them to appreciate this world that we're born into. And that's why I end the book with a sort of call for gratitude about what we've got.
Yeah, an important call. I mean, we need to be grateful, I think. And gratitude is, of course, you don't bring God in, so you have to ask the question, grateful to whom or to what?
But sure.
Let me, before I go there, when you talk about barbarians at the gates or wherever they may be, barbarians in general, many and hate, many people immediately think of the present administration.
Sure. I'm fairly,
you're a conservative.
I'm a conservative, but I am a fairly famous critic of the current president.
And one of the never Trumpers?
I was a never Trumper until he was elected. And then for me, never Trump always meant I wasn't going to vote for him. I wasn't going to endorse him. My vote, I never thought really mattered much. I've never lived anywhere my vote wasn't canceled out, at least 9-1. But what I wasn't going to do was all of a sudden lie and start saying that his language, his behavior, his character are exemplary or laudatory or anything like that. And so I guess the term, I'm not a member of the resistance. I'm perfectly happy to say I approve of some of the things that Donald Trump is doing, but I would call myself a Trump skeptic in the sense that when he gets it right, I'll say so, or when he stumbles into getting it right, I'll say so, which I think happens more often than a lot of people on my side are willing to say. But when he gets it wrong, I'll say so too. I think that's sort of, I think a lot of journalistic ethics are overblown. But one of the things I passionately believe in is that I have an obligation to tell the truth as I see it.
We're talking to Jonah Goldberg. He is senior editor for the National Review, author of The Suicide of the West, How the Rebirth of Populism, Nationalism, and Identity Politics is Destroying American Democracy. And he'll be speaking at the Commonwealth Club tomorrow evening at 6:30 p.m. And what do you say to the argument, which I often hear, and I'm sure you often hear, that the Tea Party, the conservative Republicans, paved the way for Trump? Trump necessarily wouldn't necessarily have ascended if it hadn't been for, shall we say, the GOP and its rather right-wing and more extreme form of conservatism.
Yeah, I would not argue that the Tea Party is to blame for the rise of Donald Trump. I would say the Tea Party's failures are more to blame for the rise of Donald Trump. I think I have been writing against populism for 20 years. The Tea Party movement was one of the only movements that I ever support, populist movements I ever supported, in part because I thought it was going to fulfill that ancient libertarian prophecy and take over the government and then leave everybody alone. The Tea Partiers,
What old conservatism used to be?
Yeah, you know, and I come from a sort of libertarian strain of conservatism, and the Tea Partiers were talking about limited government, back to basics, living within our means, and all of that kind of stuff. And I think the fact that they were so demonized as still being racist, because at the time the way any opposition to Barack Obama was cast, it had to be explained by racism. And I think in some ways, as I write in the book, for a lot of people or for some people on the right, that caused something of a psychic break. And they basically decided, or some people basically decided, we're going to be demonized no matter what. The identity politics left has won. So we might as well give in and have an identity politics for white people.
Demonizing white people, essentially, was.
Yeah.
And there you get into your argument about identity politics. But you also, and I think this is fair-minded of you, especially since you're associated with conservatism, it's not what the Trump administration did. Talk about identity politics of alt-right and movements like that, what we saw in Charlottesville.
Oh, I thought Donald Trump's response to Charlottesville was hideous. And I am among the most hated people in America by the alt-right.
Your name Goldberg doesn't help.
No, it doesn't. The Anti-Defamation League came out with a ranking of the most targeted public figures of alt-right anti-Semitism. I think I came in sixth on the list.
You disappointed? You weren't higher?
No, because six was just fine by me. It was pretty ugly stuff. But the alt-right which I am glad to say I think is receding in large part. It's still out there as sort of a fever swamp kind of thing on the web, but it is an explicitly identitarian thing, and I don't like identitarianism. I also don't think that Donald Trump – I think Donald Trump – getting back to your previous question, I think it's a fair one. Donald Trump is not the cause of all of our problems. He's a symptom of a lot of our problems. And in some respects, he's making a lot of those problems worse. There's a great line from Orwell where he says, a man can feel himself a failure and take to drink and become all the more of a failure because he drinks. There has been this strain of sort of white identity politics on the right for a long time, but it was largely held at bay if you actually read intellectual journals. And it is no longer held in bay the same way. The way evangelical Christians, for example, have changed their attitudes on a host of issues just simply to defend Donald Trump, I think is incredibly dismaying.
You think that has to do, to the large part, with the fact that he is supporting not only people like Gorsuch, but certainly conservatives to go on the Supreme Court, and also supporting the idea that fetuses should not be in any way destroyed?
Yeah. No, look, I get the transaction, and it's explained often. The best defense of it is a transactional one. What bothers me is, I'll give you an example. In 2011, Pew, I think it was, asked Americans whether or not a politician could have bad morals in his private life and still be a good public leader. And as you would expect, self-identified evangelical Christians were the least likely to agree with that. Only 30% said that you could have bad morals in your private life and be a good public servant. Come 2016, something like 71% of self-identified evangelicals said you can have bad morals in your private life, making, oddly enough, self-identified evangelicals the most tolerant of personal impropriety and sexual peccadilloes of any demographic in America. And if you want to defend, if pro-lifers and constitutional, you know, strict constructionists, of which I am one, want to defend Donald Trump on a transactional basis, that's fine with me. But going out and actually saying that his affair with Stormy Daniels and all these things is good or fine, or defending Roy Moore and that kind of thing, and actually bending your ideal to fit the person, I think is a deep sign of the corrupting influence that that sort of populism and identity politics and what we could call nationalism is having on conservatism in America generally.
Well, isn't it fair to say most of your criticism has been directed toward the left and the identity politics of the left more than the evangelicals or those who have supported conservative causes?
Well, I mean, over my career, sure. I think that's entirely fair. A lot of the ideas on the right have been percolating up, have really only sort of broken through in the last, you know, few years, to the extent that I feel that they're no longer sort of defensible. But I also, you know, there's a narrative on the left that there is no blame to go around about Donald Trump. He is purely a creation of the right. I understand why the left would want to argue that, but that's not how politics works. Politics is dialectic. And a lot of the, if you actually talk to Trump supporters, who I think, you know, aren't necessarily racist or deplorable, the arguments you get from them are that he's fighting back, that you know, rural Americans, poor white Americans, middle class Americans are being denigrated by the culture, that identity politics is running rampant, and that we need to sort of fight fire with fire. And I think that there is, even if I may disagree with some of the factual arguments that they make in terms of, you know, blaming everything on immigration, when I think immigration is a very small part of the problems of dislocation and automation and whatnot. Same thing with trade. The feelings, I think, are legitimate and are worth sort of respecting. It's a very strange thing that the heart of the FDR coalition, blue-collar, non-college-educated, white working class, all of a sudden became racist after 70 years of being reliable Democratic voters. I truly believe that most of our political problems are symptoms of larger cultural forces that are way upstream of Washington.
Speaking of Washington, there was a review of your book I happened to see in the Washington Monthly, just apropos of what we're talking about now in the same context. And it's done by a guy who is editor of Current Affairs. And a lot of reviews of your book have been good. His was mixed. It was mixed mainly, I think, for political reasons. And what he said, in effect, was, you know, you criticize Trump for being boorish and for his character and all the rest of that. But you're with Trump on most of his policies. And he talks about the fact that Many conservatives feel the way you do, and they don't address what needs to be addressed by the Trump administration, issues like low wages. You mentioned before economic inequality, but they also talk about social inequality and the sort of thing that's often labeled under the rubric of social justice warriors, you know, almost kind of poking fun at them or ridiculing them, but nevertheless having real issues that need to be taken under consideration and the government needs to avail itself of considering.
Well, you know, I'm not exactly shocked that someone who's of a left-wing or liberal bent, whatever you want to call it, doesn't like my policy prescriptions. Because, I mean, part of my argument is that
– Well, there's a deeper argument, though, here. I think he's saying you're against Trump but not against Trumpism, maybe.
Well, again, we have a definitional problem, but what Trumpism means. I tend to believe that Trumpism should not be understood as a political agenda so much as a psychological phenomenon. Donald Trump is a unique figure in American politics insofar as he actually has very few ideological commitments. He knows very little about policy. He's a sort of a thumbless grasp on intellectual affairs generally. And there are a few things. On trade, which I think he's completely wrong on immigration, where I think there's a kernel of a point, but I think he's a demagogue about. There are a couple of things where he's been consistent over time, although he hasn't been consistent on immigration. He used to be for the Dreamers, and he attacked Mitt Romney for being too tough on immigrants. But on things like trade—
He used to be pro-choice
back
in the day.
But that goes to my point. What Donald Trump demands of people is praise, and he doesn't really care what the praise is for. And part of the problem that we have on big chunks of the right these days is that it is not adherence to an ideological agenda. It's not an adherence to Bannonism. Trumpism is basically a personality cult, that if Trump is for it, you got to be for it. If Trump is against it, you got to be against it. And you know, this goes to the heart of what populism is all about. William Jennings Bryan, one of the most famous populists of the 19th century, had this famous line where he said, "The people of Nebraska are for free silver. Therefore, I am for free silver. I will look up the arguments later." It is a fundamentally anti-intellectual pose that some people feel obliged to dress up as some sort of an intellectually coherent ideological agenda, and I just don't think it is. But if the criticism of me or my book is that I'm actually a principled conservative who hasn't changed my views on a host of issues because Donald Trump either agrees with me or disagrees with me, then I plead guilty as charged.
And the other conservatives, especially members of the GOP who go along with President Trump, who do not, in fact, stand up to him either out of fear of that 34, whatever the percent is of his base, or out of fear, for that matter, that they're going to have other consequences. I mean, because he, you know, is known for his vindictiveness. And I mean, you know, they're going along in many cases with take the recent example. We just talked about it with Jake Tapper in the last hour about somebody in the Trump administration making a dig at a man who's suffering from glioblastoma, McCain, American hero.
I think that's hideous. And
Lindsey Graham came out and said some things, but most of them are quiet.
No, I agree, and because that's the safe harbor. And so this gets to my point about Trumpism being a psychological thing. Back when Steve Bannon, advisor to the president, was still in the White House, he would declare open war on Mitch McConnell and Jeff Flake and Corker and a few other people, trying to basically pelt them out of the GOP. And the argument was that they weren't supporting the Trump agenda. But if you actually look at what people like McConnell, Corker, Flake, Ben Sasse do, is they actually vote with the vast majority of the so-called Trump agenda, because that's actually the McConnell agenda. What they don't do, or what they didn't do, was simply praise every terrible statement that Donald Trump made as if it was okay or just some sort of minor, you know, glitch. Meanwhile, someone like Rand Paul, who has done more to undermine Trump's actual legislative agenda in the Senate than almost anybody else, isn't a target of the Bannon crowd, precisely because in public he praises Donald Trump while he votes to undermine Donald Trump. So this is my point about it being a personality cult.
It's more than that. It gets back to your book in terms of a kind of toxic populism. I mean, go after the professional politicians, and that becomes a populist anthem.
That's right. This idea that the establishment, you know, populism is almost always conspiratorial in nature, because the definition of the people is never actually all of the people. It is a subset of the people who feel aggrieved by powers that be, whether they be globalists or some other thing, or the Jews. And so the ethos of the populism out there is, on the right, is that there are these sinister forces out to get their sort of Joan of Arc avatar, Donald Trump, and that they must all be thrown out. And I I'm a bit of an institutionalist, I get. I think that generally the point of our founding of our Constitution is to temper populist outrage and channel it in productive means. You know, that's why we have the legislative branch designed the way it is. And but Donald Trump has tapped into this feeling that the system is out to get us. And that's an argument that we've seen historically very much on the left. I mean, it was very interesting that the two populists who captured the imagination of the two parties, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, one was a Jewish guy from Vermont, but really from Brooklyn. And the other was a Manhattan billionaire. These are usually the types that populists point their pitchforks at, not rally around. But that's sort of the place that we are in culturally, because faith and trust in institutions is broken down.
Talking again with Jonah Goldberg, and he's the author of a new book called The Suicide of the West. Sounds like Spengler, by the way, when I read that title. But the subtitle is the key here, How the Rebirth of Populism, Nationalism, and Identity Politics is Destroying American Democracy. Isn't it true that nationalism, I'm a pretty serious student of history, often leads to war?
It does. And this is a debate I'm having with a lot of my friends on the right, including colleagues of mine at National Review, about nationalism. I think it was that Washington Monthly review that you referenced earlier. Criticizes me because I say that tribalism is natural, nationalism is natural, and that you can't get rid of them entirely, which I think is true.
There's a whole spectrum of both, though, really, isn't there?
Yeah. But my point about, say, nationalism is that it's sort of like salt. A pinch brings out the flavor in the meal, ties everything together.
We had that quote in our billboard, actually.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, we did this morning.
The problem is when these things get toxic, because all poisons are determined by the dose. And so I think a little nationalism is necessary to bind people together, to give a sense of solidarity, to say this country is mine and I will love it. But you don't want to all of a sudden turn it into a kind of ethno-nationalism, which is inherently exclusionary. And this is something that Orwell writes a lot about and notes on nationalism, about a lot of nationalism it tends to be just sort of negatively defined. It's sort of it's defined by who you hate. And I think that's the danger that comes with nationalism.
Second reference by conservative Jonah Goldberg to Orwell.
And, I'm a big fan of Orwell.
I'm going to give out the phone number and invite you, our listeners, to join us. We do welcome your involvement in the program if you have questions or comments or responses to what you're hearing here, particularly about the rebirth of populism, nationalism, and identity politics. Is it indeed destroying American democracy, and particularly what was called liberal capitalism of American democracy and democracy in the West? Welcome your involvement. You can join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to be part of the program. Again, you can join us by calling 866-733-6786 or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website and posting questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Please feel free to be part of the program. And again, Jonah Goldberg will be at the Commonwealth Club tomorrow night at 6:30. He's with us for the rest of the hour. Feel free to join us. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Jonah Goldberg, senior editor for the National Review and author of The Suicide of the West, How the Rebirth of Populism, Nationalism, and Identity Politics is Destroying American Democracy. And if you have something you'd like to say or ask, we welcome your involvement. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You know, I was just thinking of the fact that you're also pretty much become a regular contributor to NPR. How's that working out?
It's great so far. I mean, I like to joke that I'm the house goy at NPR. It's a funny thing about the sort of polarized nature of our times is that a lot of people on the right, especially if you read too much Twitter, which I don't recommend, think that's all the proof you need that I have, I've become a, an ersatz liberal or a Vichy rhino or something like that. And I enjoyed it. I've always listened to a lot of NPR, including the show.
You also are writing regularly and have been for some time columns for the Los Angeles Times, and I just want to ask you a quick question about that, because I found an article that was actually in the Sunday paper in the Los Angeles Times about the Supreme Court being too partisan, mm-hmm. and also not only too partisan, just like some thoughts from you on this in relationship to the column you wrote. too powerful. I mean, going back to Bork, it's obviously been too, as you pointed out, too partisan. Mm-hmm. But you were almost intimating that it's become legislative and taken over legislative duties.
Yeah, I think the argument I made in the column is that starting in the 60s, I would make the argument, a lot of conservatives would make the argument, that the Supreme Court arrogated to itself powers that the founding fathers didn't intend. In that, you know, and de Tocqueville, to his credit, predicted that a lot of questions would end up in the courts no matter what. But the courts basically have acted in many ways as a super legislature. And even Ruth Bader Ginsburg argued that the way they handled Roe v. Wade kind of short-circuited the normal organic functioning of democratic processes. But even more broadly, and I talk about this a bit in the book, our whole constitutional structure is kind of screwed up these days. And I think it's one of the reasons why you're getting these populist reactions, in the sense that the founding fathers, you know, if you told Hamilton or Madison that Congress would not want to be a jealous guardian of its own power, they would have thought you were crazy. And yet, you know, from the power to declare war, as we're seeing with the Syria stuff right now, to a whole sweep of things, a lot of politicians, especially a lot of congressmen, well, a lot of senators and congressmen both, they seem to be more interested in running for a pundit position, where they would rather get a spot to opine on Morning Joe or on Fox and Friends than to actually legislate. And the power in Washington is now being pushed into parts of the executive branch, but also part of the sort of the regulatory state. Congress is not much interested in legislating the way it once was. And I think that has all sorts of knock-on effects in how people view Washington, because they don't actually feel like their representatives are representing their points of view or actually trying to make constructive legislation. I think this is an indictment of the institutions, not of any single party.
All right. I want to also talk to you about popular entertainment, which has a big place in your book, an important place. But let me go to our callers and first read a tweet from a listener who says, tribalism predates and will almost definitely outlast democracy. And Joseph says, on a philosophical basis, contrast your book with Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West. I mentioned that.
Sure. There are a lot of books out there that have these sort of death of, you know, Pappy Kenneth, I think, wrote a book called Death of the West, and then there's Spengler, of course. I use it in a sort of the same reason I say that there is no God in this book at the beginning. I also say there's no such thing as the right side of history. There is no teleology. There is no cold, immutable force outside of ourselves that's going to make sure things become okay. And so the suicide of the West is about a cultural choice that we're making of a sort of turning our backs on the things that have made us so prosperous, so free, and because suicide is a choice. I'm not a Spenglerian. I'm not a Buchananite in these things. I think that Ronald Reagan was right when he said that every generation, we're always just one generation away from losing our liberty because we don't inherit it in our blood. It's something that you actually have to fight for. And I agree with the first tweet entirely. We are hardwired. A huge part of my argument is that the real threat is human nature. And when we don't civilize people properly towards ideals and goals and customs and habits of the heart, human nature takes over and our tribal natures take over. And so much of what we're seeing in our politics right now is a result of people being told, just go with your gut, go with your rage, that arguments don't matter, that persuasion doesn't matter. I think this is a bipartisan problem in our culture.
Speaking about bipartisan, I'm thinking there's a kind of binary in your book, mm-hmm. Between Rousseau on the one hand and the idea of the noble savage, and John Locke and what John Locke put forward, particularly in terms of democracy. But just now, particularly, I'm thinking more, and I was actually thinking, reading your book, of John Calvin, the other John.
Uh-huh.
No, I mean, that belief somehow that human nature is essentially, because there's somebody wired toward nativism and toward all kinds of tribalism that is toxic and that is dangerous and that is dark, whereas many people would say, no, that's a very conservative view. A lot of, how should we describe them? I don't want to be too judgmental here, but you know what people would say, kumbaya type people, but mm-hmm. There's a big spectrum here too. Believe that human nature is basically good.
Right. Let me put it this way. The Locke versus Rousseau dichotomy, I think, explains a lot about politics and intellectual history. But it also explains a lot about human nature, because it runs, that this dichotomy runs straight through the human heart. We're all a little Lockean, and that we want to be sort of individuals that we want to be recognized as individuals, but we're also all a little Rousseauian in the sense that we want to feel like we're part of a group, that we're part of a, something that's larger than ourselves, that the general will is important. And so, and I think that these things are, again, essentially hardwired into us. And the trick is not to say we all, and this is something I think David Brooks just got wrong about my book, I'm not a sort of radical libertarian individualist guy. Rather, I think that what we need is the right balance between what Friedrich Hayek called the microcosm, the world of family and friends and small institutions where we use different values of social solidarity and we don't monetize and contractualize everything, and the extended order of liberty, which Hayek called the macrocosm, which is where we treat people, we treat strangers as citizens or customers or clients. And the trick is not to conflate the two. In my view, all forms of tyranny involve trying to take the logic of the microcosm and applying it to the extended
society. So the macrocosm.
Right. And so if you want to treat the whole country like it's a family or a tribe, you're going to destroy liberty. You're going to destroy prosperity. If you want to treat the family like it's a business enterprise, you're going to destroy the family.
And we'll bring on our callers. Let me go, John, to you first. You're on the air.
Thank you, Mr. Krasny, and thank you, Mr. Jonah Goldberg, for your nuance and intellect. T45 is a psychological phenomenon. Jonah, you mentioned how people who voted for our current president feel the system is out to get us, which is a reality that all people of color face on a day-to-day basis, on much more treacherous terms. That is a fact, and that pain runs deep. Question is, should the government address these issues brought up by the so-called social justice warrior movement? We have a denialist rhetoric from the administration about the history I mentioned. So how could we expect a group of people undergoing continued trauma to not resort to tribalism given these circumstances?
Yeah, look, I think it's a fair question. I've certainly evolved on my views about such things as sort of police misconduct. I think the evidence has turned overwhelming. I think there's a lot of cross-ideological, cross-partisan ferment about doing stuff about criminal justice reform generally and prison reform generally. And I agree entirely that if you look at the history of African Americans in this country, the idea that you shouldn't credit their deep suspicion about the government and the way society is organized is sort of ludicrous to me. Of course, they have, you know, concerns. But I would also point out, you know, that one of the problems that we have in our political culture and our media climate is the insistence on focusing entirely on the negative and trying to hyperbolize how bad things are. This country is, according to every bit of social science, is dramatically less racist, less bigoted than it was even 40, 30 years ago. The rates of intermarriage between races have been climbing for decades. I don't think all of the white people who marry black people and then make babies with them can be accused credibly of being racists. And there's been and this is something that Barack Obama was very good about. You know, he talked about the incredible nature of black progress in America, and I think that's something that should be celebrated.
But we were not in a post-racial world, as was heralded with Barack Obama. And are we in a post-truth world? That's what we're hearing now about Trump.
I don't know if it's completely post-truth, but certainly truth isn't getting the credit and respect that I would like to see it get, particularly in the way a lot of the sort of national discourse is unfolding.
Let me go to more calls. Bill, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. Jonah Goldberg, I've enjoyed all the interviews I've seen you in. I'm a little more liberal than you, but you're a great voice. I have a question. I grew up surrounded by the old conservative movement in America, and Donald Trump said that he loves the poorly educated. What is the future of the Republican Party if that's what the leader of the Republican Party says about his constituents? Is it that he can fool them most of the time or all the time? What do you think about that?
Right. Well, first of all, whenever I hear opening praise like that, I'm reminded of this old story where LBJ in the 1940s, when he was a congressman, called the New Republic and begged them to stop complimenting him because it was killing him in his district. Look, I take a backseat to almost nobody in my criticisms of Donald Trump's rhetoric. A big part of my argument, which I get largely from Deirdre McCloskey, an economic historian, is that the best explanation, I don't think it completely captures it, but the best explanation for the miracle, this explosion of prosperity and tolerance and all these things that is still unfolding, comes from rhetoric, from words. All a civilization is the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. The moral triumph of Martin Luther King's speech at the March on Washington is that he was appealing to, quote-unquote, white America's best version of themselves and pointing out to them that they were falling short. Words matter a great deal, and the way you frame things matters a great deal. And, you know, my problems with Donald Trump go back to the campaign where he would say, he says, I'm a conservative, but who cares? Really, that doesn't matter. His touchstones were winning and strength, which are fundamentally amoral positions. Winning for what? Strength to what end? And so I think enormous damage is being done. And it's very interesting how younger conservatives, you know, millennials and slightly older, are much more troubled by the way Donald Trump talks than older conservatives are. Ben Shapiro runs through a lot of this data in the latest Weekly Standard. Something like 82% of 18 to 24-year-old young conservatives want to see Donald Trump primaried in 2020. But meanwhile, 65 and olders don't. And I think this has in part to do with the fact that a lot of older conservatives have just simply abandoned their conviction that character matters or that rhetoric matters. And it's going to take a generation of people trying to rebuild and fix a lot of the damage that's being done. And it starts with words. It starts, you know, that's part of the point of this book. I started writing this book when no one thought Donald Trump was going to run for president, including Donald Trump. It's not a book about Donald Trump, but the timing is fortuitous because he is sort of a good case study in a lot of the points that I'm trying to make.
And let me thank Bill for the call. You make a point about looking over some course offerings at Yale University.
Uh-huh.
Can you say something about that? Because it's real, certainly revelatory.
Sure. So one of the things, so it's funny, when I talk to a lot of left-wing, you know, interviewers, and I don't have a bead on your ideological stance, which I think speaks well to you, but a lot of people from the left side of the aisle really come after me about the identity politics stuff. And the people on the right side of the aisle come after me about the nationalism stuff or the populism stuff. And so part of my point, and this gets to my point about how we don't focus on any progress. At Yale, we've seen all these controversies of late about how, you know, minorities feel oppressed. There was this whole thing where they got rid of the word master for like the RAs in some dorm because master conjured images of slavery, these fights over free speech. And there's this running theme about how, you know, minorities, people of color, women need these safe spaces. They need to be respected. And if you actually go through the course catalog at Yale, Yale's been in the process of respecting these points of view for a generation. There are scores of courses on everything you can imagine, everything a social justice warrior would want to see courses on. There are almost no courses on the American founding or the Revolutionary War. Meanwhile, at Yale and plenty of other schools, there are dozens of identity politics safe spaces, the African American Students Union, the Hispanic Caucus, you know, whatever. You can go down a list for, you know, every kind of sort of transgender, gay, all of these kinds of things. All of these spaces have been carved out for people who feel like they need to be respected. And yet the response is always, this is not enough, that there is still this vestigial bigotry and oppression lurking within these institutions. And in a lot of ways, I think it's symptomatic of a larger problem we have in our culture, which is sort of that we have kind of an autoimmune disease where when you have an autoimmune disease, your antibodies attack healthy institutions as if or healthy organs as if they're foreign invaders or diseased. And this is something I think that the left does a great deal where they don't want to focus on the sort of positive role that a lot of these institutions play. Instead, they still want to focus on the idea that they are still bastions of white supremacy and oppression and homophobia, when it's very difficult to find anybody who would even remotely fit those descriptions running these institutions or teaching there.
Some would argue, though, that these safe spaces are really necessary, maybe even vital. Just last week, you may have read, there was a racist incident. I don't know how else to describe it. A young woman who was actually, white students called the cops because she was sleeping in a part of the dormitory room, I guess, and she belonged there. That was part of where she was supposed to be. But, you know, the fact that she was like Starbucks, the fact that she was black may have had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I'm not sure that safe spaces would solve that, but I have no problem conceding that we are not a perfect society. I also have no problem conceding that it is impossible to have a perfect society. What you strive for is a good society. You can't create a heaven on earth. And do we have work that needs to be done? Do we need to improve some things? Sure. The idea that our institutions aren't aimed at doing that, I just find fanciful. And the idea that we're going to focus exclusively or intensely simply on the negative stories without, you know, paying any attention to the forest of positive stories around them, I think is a mistake.
And again, Jonah Goldberg is our guest, and he is senior editor for the National Review, author of The Suicide of the West. And let me get another caller on here. Let's go next to you. Reed, thank you for waiting. Join us.
Hello. Thank you. I think it's interesting that you should talk about Yale, because when I was in 1958, when I began college, the National Review had just been, a couple of years before, it had been founded by William F. Buckley, who wrote God and Man at Yale, and was himself Catholic, as were many on the staff of the National Review at that time. When Bertrand Russell was talking about better red than dead, and Buckley, I think, would have said better dead than red. So I congratulate you, Mr. Goldberg, on the fact that you're coming from a secular space, which I find very interesting, and it certainly was not true of the National Review at that time. Would you care to comment any further about that?
Sure. I've gotten some grief for the opening sentence of the book, but I'm not doing it. I'm not coming from the perspective of atheism. I am not an atheist. What I am trying to do is persuade people. So much of the problems that have got us to where we are on the right these days have to do with this obsession with ideological purity on the right. And I'm a pretty ideologically consistent, you know, conservative guy. But that's not what politics is supposed to be about. Politics is supposed to be about persuasion. Go back to Aristotle.
It's supposed to be about compromise, at least American politics, isn't it?
That's a big part of it, too. It's about bringing people in one coalition into your coalition by saying that their interests are better served in your coalition than the one they're currently in. And what so many people on the right want to do now is just simply, or at least until the rise of Donald Trump, proclaim their purity in a way that would turn off people.
Both sides, though, both, right?
Yeah, and I think it happens on the left too, of course. But the reason why I keep God out of it, although he is kind of sneak back in at the end, is that appealing to God. You know, I have no problem with my friends on the right who want to say this all comes from God and it's providential and all the rest. But that is an appeal to authority, and in logic, appeals to authority are a fallacy unless everybody already is committed to that authority. Two brothers can say to each other, we can't do this because Dad says so. But you can't use that argument with a stranger. And so what I am trying to do is argue on, you know, you can call it the lefts or progressives or the secular, you know, moderns, whatever you want to call them. I'm trying to argue on the terms that the left claims they hold dear. And I think sincerely, which is that it's empirical, it's evolution-based, it's science-based, it's history-based, it's fact-based. And I'm trying to make the argument that even on their terms, liberal democratic capitalism is this incredible gift that has given us enormous benefits. And it's the only system ever that has, in a sustained way, alleviated human suffering. Poverty is natural. What we live in this civilization, is unnatural.
Well, let me give there's some pushback on that, and I'd like to get your thoughts. Looking at some comments here, Lori, for example, says, today 2 billion people still cannot afford a healthy diet, much less meet other basic human needs. How can you argue that capitalism is wonderful for those people? You're talking mainly about North America and Europe, she argues, although there's a lot of capitalism in Asia. And another listener, sort of along similar lines, Jessica, says, your guest talks as though capitalism always results in benevolent benefits for all, but it's largely been built by, for, and of whites. Why should people of color embrace your call to turn away from their positive nationalist identity and back toward the benevolent white-run capitalism?
I have just flat-out complete disagreement with both callers or both listeners. First of all, poverty is natural. For 250,000 years, there's an overwhelming consensus that the average human being everywhere in the world lived on $3 a day or less. the fact that there are still poor people in some parts of the world today is evidence that markets haven't done have not spread far enough. Meanwhile, in the last 30 years, hundreds of billions of people have been lifted out of poverty in Asia and Africa because of market-based systems. Socialism and nationalism and all of these kinds of things, they may feel like they fill the hole in your soul because they are natural, but they actually do not create prosperity and wealth. And, you know, China in 1978 embraced markets, and hundreds of millions of people could eat meat for the first time, could read for the first time, and it wasn't because of socialism.
Listen to Forum, and we're talking with Jonah Goldberg, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let's go to another caller here, and that's you. Sonia, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, my question to Mr. Goldberg pertains to something he said a while ago, that the Supreme Court has become too powerful and too legislative in its role. And I'm curious to know what your opinion is on the Citizens United decision. It seems to me that Citizens United is an extreme example of identity politics, where an inhuman entity can have and enjoy the same rights as a human being. And can you blame a Black Lives Matter activist for thinking that Black Lives Matter when it seems that a corporation has more rights than a Black person in some ways?
Yeah.
I'd like to know what Mr. Goldberg's thoughts are on that.
Yeah,
thanks for the question, Sonia.
I gotta say, I'm at a loss at how Citizens United reflects identity politics. You can argue that it was a bad decision. I don't. I think there has been an enormous amount of misunderstanding about Citizens United. I don't blame Black Lives Matter for having the sincerely held convictions that they have. I don't think it is right or true to say that Black people in this country have fewer rights than corporations have. That just seems to me like a category error. But if the argument is that we shouldn't treat corporations as corporate persons, right, which is it's not that no one actually thinks that corporations are people. But the idea of corporate personhood, which is a very ancient one, if we got rid of that, then all of a sudden, you know, what do we do about all sorts of, you know, activist organizations and newspapers and media organizations, corporations, the ability to incorporate. As I think is sort of a central part of sort of economic prosperity. And you can argue about how you want to treat campaign finance reform, but I think it's largely become a boogeyman in a lot of people's minds.
Again, our guest is Jonah Goldberg, and I sort of indicated that I wanted to talk with you about entertainment. So I don't want to obviate that, or I don't want to simply foreclose that possibility here. You do have an argument here that a lot of entertainment is the result. Well, actually, the premise has to do with post-Watergate. You see a lot of portrayals of American institutions, especially those who are supposed to mete out justice, or, you know, American government, police, and so forth, generally strongly negative.
Yeah, I mean, I have this chapter about popular culture, which the intended point of it was to point out that when we go to a movie, when we watch a TV show, there's a tiny part of our brain that understands that this is not actually happening. But the part that motivates us, that moves us out of our seat, that makes us engage and be invested in characters, doesn't actually realize that this is fiction. And I wanted to explore that in part because I wanted to point out that the way we're viewing politics now is as a form of entertainment. And we, when you view politics as a form of entertainment, that is a way of your sort of tribal mind coming to the fore. And it's amazing to me how much, when we look at entertainment, our moral structure is completely different than in our everyday lives. In our everyday lives, we mostly understand that violence is wrong, that torture is wrong. But when you see it in the movies, the audience cheers when the good guy does violence against the bad guy, or even tortures the bad guy. And when you sort of take, and that's our sort of our sense of tribal justice being satiated.
It's playing to viscera, really.
That's right. That's right. And these days in politics, I call it our ecstatic schadenfreude, where we are being told more and more and more on the right and the left just that certain things, this sort of gets to your post-truth question, that doing something is justified solely if it makes our enemies unhappy. One of my favorite cartoons, my wife got it blown up, comes from The New Yorker, and I have it framed in my office. and has two dogs sitting at a bar, and one dog says to the other dog, you know, over martinis, you know, it's not good enough that dogs succeed. Cats must also fail.
I remember that cartoon. It's a great cartoon. Again, Jonah Goldberg's our guest this hour. Do we have time? I'll try to get another caller in here quickly, but it's going to have to be quick, I'm afraid. Shabazz, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. The idea that corporations can be seen as persons is really ridiculous. You know, people—you don't get people with billions and billions of dollars who are able to contribute to political campaigns. And so, it's intelligent to say that they don't have the same power that corporations have. So, when we look at corporations as a person, then you see the politicians being bought out, they're being sold out.
Shabazz, we're going to have a whole argument here about Citizens United. I didn't anticipate, but let's get a quick response to the gist of your comment from Jonah Goldberg.
Yeah, I think that corporations have a free speech right just as newspapers have a free speech right. Corporations have a free speech right. They're run by human beings. They have the ability in a free system to express their interests. They can't give billions of dollars directly to campaigns. They can launch efforts to publicly to persuade the public, as can people from another perspective. I just think this has all been overblown.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, Jonah Goldberg. Good to have you here in studio with us.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.